country.
Thank you, and that concludes general questions. We turn now to First Minister's questions. Question number one, Ruth Davidson.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. When you visit schools, people are most likely to tell you what you want to hear through fear of repercussions. That's the message from a primary school teacher in today's press to the Education Secretary, speaking anonymously because she fears being disciplined for speaking out. How does the First Minister think that reflects on her government?
First Minister.
Well, firstly, I should say that teachers, parents, sometimes older pupils, email me regularly, I'm sure it's the case for the Deputy First Minister, openly telling us their views on schools. Often they will talk about the very many positives about school education. At other times they will point out things that they think we should be doing better. So my message to any teacher, I've read the letter that Ruth Davidson has referred to, is that nobody should feel unable to come to me or to the Education Secretary and raise concerns at any time. I encourage that, I have always encouraged that, and I always will encourage that. But I also think it's important that we remain very focused on making sure we're investing properly in our schools, reducing where we can unnecessary workload for teachers, and taking the action through, for example, the Pupil Equity Fund and the governance reforms in our schools to do what I have said is such a driving priority for this government, which is to raise standards and close the attainment gap. And we will remain absolutely focused on doing exactly that.
Ruth Davidson.
The First Minister talks about reducing workload, but if that work's been undertaken, why do international studies show that our teachers are among the most overworked in the world? But let's just read out a little bit more from the letter that went to Mr. Swinney that we all received in the last week. In it, the teacher says that the Scottish Government are not tackling the real underlying issues in education, but are rather just putting a plaster over a gaping wound. And speaking directly to Mr. Swinney, she adds, "The most concerning thing that has happened so far is that one of my colleagues arranged to meet with yourself to discuss issues that were of great concern to them. However, this person was warned by their manager that if they went ahead with this meeting, they would be disciplined." Could either the Education Secretary or the First Minister say today whether they knew that that had happened, what action they took, and whether they'll end this culture of fear right now?
Well, First Minister.
I think it's very important to be clear on this, and I want to be crystal clear on this, and I would say not just to people across this chamber, but perhaps particularly to local authority employers in this regard. In the case that Ruth Davidson has mentioned, the Deputy First Minister agreed to meet with the teacher. It was not the Deputy First Minister that said that meeting could go ahead. So I am very, very clear. It's not acceptable for local authorities to say to any teacher or any member of staff, whatever job they're doing, that they will be disciplined if they approach or raise concerns with government ministers. So I can't be any clearer about that. I will go on being clear about that, and I hope that's a message that is heard loudly and clearly by local authorities right across the country. And I hope Ruth Davidson would agree with that and join with me today in sending that message.
Ruth Davidson.
I'm not sure the First Minister fully gets this, because it's her government that is decreeing to local authorities. And we're not talking about a political opponent here. This teacher isn't point scoring. We're talking about a teacher who in the letter makes clear that she's an SNP supporter and voter, and yet she now feels that she isn't being listened to and has to speak out under the cloak of anonymity in order to avoid being stamped on. So what does it come to when public servants with experience and knowledge in their area are being strong-armed to keep their mouths shut because it might embarrass the Education Secretary? Can the First Minister answer me that?
First Minister.
You know, I have to say that having read the letter that Ruth Davidson opened with in her first question, there are many serious issues in that letter that Ruth Davidson could have raised today. Issues that this government is working hard to address with the teaching profession and with others. But I think on this issue, she is on extremely weak ground indeed. So let me recap for Ruth Davidson's benefit. In this case, the Deputy First Minister agreed to meet a teacher. It was the local authority who advised that teacher not to meet. We do not decree that local authorities should do that. On the contrary, if there's any decree coming from me today to local authorities, is that that is unacceptable.
Absolutely.
That teachers should be free to contact me as First Minister, the Deputy First Minister, as Education Secretary, or indeed any member of my government. So I'm not sure how I can make that any clearer for Ruth Davidson, and perhaps she would be doing a greater service to teachers instead of standing here and pretending that there's some other policy on the part of the government, would actually be underlining the fact that any teachers anywhere in the country are perfectly free to approach any member of the government. She would do a greater service to teachers if she got that message across loudly and clearly.
Ruth Davidson.
Presiding Officer, I think the transparency and openness of government is a serious issue that is worth highlighting. And as the teacher says in the letter today, their issue isn't just about resources, it's about workforce planning, it's about a failure to implement policy properly, it's about a failure to listen to people in the front line, a charge that's made front and centre. It's about a culture of fear and secrecy that is currently stopping people from speaking out because of the repercussions for their careers. So we do need an openness in government in Scotland, one which welcomes transparency and scrutiny, not just because a letter was written, a government that asks teachers to tell them what's happening, and not one that forces them to keep their mouth shut. Wouldn't you agree?
First Minister. Now,
let me issue this message to teachers or to any other public sector worker across the country. Come and tell the government how you feel about your job and your public services, whether that is good or bad, whether that's about positives or things we want to do better. And actually, Ruth Davidson would be better advised to join me in putting that message out there. Openness and transparency is hugely important. That's why the Deputy First Minister is in schools every single week. That's why he and I talk to teachers regularly, not just in my capacity as First Minister, but in my constituency surgeries, of which I do many. And that message is one that we should all convey to teachers. So for what, the third or fourth time, let me be clear to teachers that they can come and raise anything they want with the government. And let me be very clear to every single local authority of every party administration across the country that it is unacceptable to say to any teacher that they will be disciplined for doing so. So I think I've made that pretty clear, and I hope it's widely understood, not just by Ruth Davidson, but by everybody across Scotland.
Question number two, Richard Leonard.
Presiding Officer, this week the highly respected Joseph Rowntree Foundation published its annual Poverty in Scotland report. It showed that one in four children in Scotland today live in poverty. The First Minister has set a target to make that less than one in 10 by 2030. But what is her target for 2019?
First Minister.
Well, firstly, we welcome the Joseph Rowntree Foundation's report. It clearly outlines the challenges we all face in tackling poverty. Of course, the Scottish Government has set targets. I think we're now the only part of the UK that has binding statutory targets in place. We've also set out a range of initiatives we're going to take to meet those targets in terms of our child poverty action plan. But I think it's important to look at some of the detail of the Joseph Rowntree report. I mean, Jim McCormick, the director, Scottish director of the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, said on Good Morning Scotland on Tuesday, it's right to say that the single biggest reason why child poverty is now going in the wrong direction again, at the first sustained rise in 20 years, is down to the long-run benefits freeze at UK level, the two-child limit, and the freeze in tax credits and universal credit. So perhaps the attack by Richard Leonard on the Scottish Government would have more credibility if he was arguing for welfare to be completely devolved to this Parliament. And finally, of course, the report also goes on to praise the forthcoming Scottish Government strategies on disability employment, on the gender pay gap, describing them as transformational, and also praises our approach to the new social security system. So where we have power, we act. The problem is we don't have enough power to do enough that needs to be done.
Richard Leonard.
So let's be clear, the First Minister has a target for 12 years' time, but not for 12 months' time. One act that would make an immediate difference to child poverty is increasing child benefit. Over the last year, this Parliament has passed a Social Security Act and a Child Poverty Act. In voting through both of these acts, SNP MSPs opposed proposals to increase child benefit. Yet this policy has support across Civic Scotland, from anti-poverty organisations to faith groups, from children's charities to the Scottish TUC. They all support the Give Me Five campaign to raise child benefit by £5 a week. They all support it because it will lift children out of poverty. Does the First Minister know how many children would be lifted out of poverty by this increase?
First Minister.
The estimate shows that that policy would lift 20,000 children out of poverty, which would mean a drop in child poverty of just 2 percentage points. Now, I'm not saying that is insignificant, but what I'm saying is if we are going to introduce an income supplement, which we are committed to doing, we must make sure that the money that is invested in that has maximum effectiveness in tackling child poverty. So what we're looking at is the best way to do that, because the policy that Richard Leonard is proposing, 7 out of every £10 invested through that policy would go to families who are not living in poverty. So the question is, if we're going to invest this scale of money, how do we lift not just 20,000 children out of poverty, how do we use that money to lift even more children out of poverty? That's the work we are doing, and I hope Richard Leonard and his party will get behind it.
Richard Leonard.
In fact, Presiding Officer, the answer to the question I asked is not 20,000 children, it's 30,000 children who would be lifted out of poverty. So, First Minister, that could be your 2019 target. 30,000 children in Scotland lifted out of poverty. Because the report from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation makes clear that it is time, and I quote them, to take decisive steps to make the transformational change. And it also makes clear that many of the tools to tackle poverty and its causes lie in the hands of this Parliament. Mm-hmm. More flexible and affordable childcare, better housing for all, and a labour market strategy aligned with the goal of reducing poverty. No, because what we have instead is a childcare policy that fits on an SNP leaflet, but not around the lives of working people. A housing policy which offers help to buy to those earnings over £100,000 a year, and a labour market strategy that has been gathering dust on the shelf for over 2 years. Presiding Officer, the SNP has been in office for 11 years. Nicola Sturgeon has been First Minister for 4 years. This is Challenge Poverty Week. So let me challenge the First Minister. How much longer is this government going to tinker around the edges? And how many more children in Scotland will grow up in grinding poverty as a result?
First Minister.
Let me address some of the points that were raised in that. I'm not sure if it's a question rather than a speech, but take childcare. We are in the process right now of doubling childcare for 3- and 4-year-olds and vulnerable 2-year-olds. We're midway through the biggest house building project in the history of this Parliament. I seem to recall it was 6 council houses that the last Labour administration managed to build. Let's look at what the Joseph Rowntree Foundation says about some of our policies, the disability employment strategy, our work and gender pay gap, and I'm quoting right now, this could be transformational for tackling poverty. Our approach to the new social security system could change the family incomes and prospects of thousands of children for the better. And yes, we will continue to focus on how an income supplement, which we are committed to introducing, it will lift as many children as possible out of poverty, and will not see 7 out of every £10 that we invest of that going to families that don't live in poverty. If we're serious about tackling child poverty, that's the right approach to take. And lastly, Presiding Officer, I don't know about my tenure as First Minister, but Richard Leonard has been leader of the Scottish Labour Party for a lot less time than I've been First Minister of Scotland. And here's what somebody in his party said about him this week. Richard Leonard has no authority over his group. If he's serious about leading Scottish Labour, he should be apologising. I couldn't have summed it up any better.
We have some constituency and other supplementaries. The first from Andy Order, please. The first from Andy Whiteman.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. The First Minister will be aware that the Scottish Land Court has refused an application to evict a constituent of mine, Jim Telfer, a tenant under the Small Landholders Scotland Act 1911, in order to sell the land to developers to build the Pentland Film Studio that Scottish Ministers granted planning consent to in December 2017. Does the First Minister agree that this proposal is now dead in the water and that the Scottish Government and its agency should take the lead in identifying a site for a film studio that does not involve the unlawful eviction of anyone?
First Minister.
Well, firstly, the judgment by the Scottish Land Court, of course, is a legal matter. I understand that there is likely to be an appeal of that decision, so for obvious reasons, I cannot comment on the specifics of it at this time. What I will say is the Scottish Government backs the expansion of the screen sector. We welcome private sector proposals to develop a range of studio infrastructure, but ultimately this is a matter for the current owner of that site ahead of a potential sale to the studio developers. And although we have a role in planning surrounding the project, the issue of land ownership and tenancies is properly considered by the Land Court. Of course, separately to that issue, Creative Scotland is seeking to launch a tender in the autumn, seeking investors to operate a public sector-backed film studio. These plans, of course, are not dependent on the development at the Pentland site.
And June McAlpine.
Thank you. Is the First Minister aware of the situation facing tenant farmers David and Alison Telfer, who are being forced off Clifffoot Farm near Langham by the Duke of Buccleuch? Next week, the Duke plans to value their hefted sheep, which have been on the hill for centuries, to be sold to make way for trees. Does the First Minister agree with me that forestry planting grants should never be given in these circumstances, that the Telfers' human rights are being violated by Buccleuch Estates, and that the Duke's sale of the 9,000-acre Evertown portfolio, which includes the Telfers farm and their home, contravenes regulations enacted by the Land Reform Scotland Act 2016, which says that landowners should formally engage with the community ahead of major changes?
First Minister.
Yes, I am aware of this particular case, and I would say that I share Joe McAlpine's concern. Guidance for landowners makes very clear that communities should play a part in decisions about how land is used and managed. I know that the Scottish Land Commission has written to Buccleuch Estates to advise them of how the community should be involved and has offered to provide further advice. Human rights are also reflected in the guidance which landowners, including Buccleuch Estates, should take into consideration during this or any process relating to land transactions. Guidance on the forestry grant scheme state that applicants must have control of the land and a legal right to plant trees on the land. Where control of land changes or comes out of farming, there must be no doubt about the applicant's legal right to plant trees. We intend to add additional guidance to clarify that where an applicant's control of the land or legal right to plant trees is subject to a live legal challenge or review, we would not consider the land to be eligible for a forestry grant until any legal process had been concluded.
And Oliver Mundell.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. This week, we've seen Church Place GP Surgery in Moffat close its doors forever due to staffing issues. Meanwhile, patients in neighbouring Johnston Bridge have been told that there are no appointments available because there are no doctors to see them. Does the First Minister think that this is acceptable? And in light of these failings, will she back local calls to accelerate plans for a new purpose-built health centre in Upper Annandale?
First Minister.
Well, we will always discuss with health boards plans for new health centres, and of course it's very much for local health boards to decide on local priorities. More generally, we have an aim to increase the number of GPs working in Scotland by at least 800 over the next decade. Investment in primary care is rising. We're taking a range of actions to increase the numbers of medical students going into GP training. In fact, the Graduate Entry Medicine Programme, which will have a focus on general practice, starts this year. I know the Health Secretary, Jean Freeman, visited the start of the programme earlier this week. Jean Freeman has also been at the RCGP conference this morning, and many of the tweets I've seen from that were suggesting that the UK government should look to what the Scottish government is doing and learn lessons from that. So perhaps the member might want to pass that on. I think the tweet that most drew my attention was, "Can someone please give Matt Hancock a copy of Jean Freeman's speech?"
And another from Lewis MacDonald.
Thank you very much, Presiding Officer. Members across the chamber were pleased earlier this week when the Sports Minister agreed to engage with all relevant parties about the SPFL's plans to hold both League Cup semi-finals in the same venue. on the same day, and even more pleased when those plans were dropped yesterday evening. Will the First Minister continue that engagement and ensure that this is the very last time that those scheduling such major events do so without taking the interests of supporters into account?
First Minister.
Well, these of course are decisions for the footballing authorities, in this case the SPFL, although they should listen to police advice, and I'm glad that the change of opinion has happened this week. In terms of making sure that any appropriate lessons are learned, the Justice Secretary is, and I think perhaps has already, arranged a meeting between Police Scotland and the SPFL to look at what happened this time and how we can make sure that these things don't happen again in future. And I hope football fans of all teams and all colours will welcome that for the future.
Question number three, Willie Rennie.
I'm worried about the First Minister. She's not quite herself these days. Our country is facing economic meltdown, but the First Minister is frozen with indecision. For months, I've encouraged her to back a people's vote on Brexit, but she just can't make up her mind. Then I hear this week that she's delayed another independence referendum. That's great news, but I do wonder, does the First Minister believe in anything anymore? I want to encourage the First Minister. I'll be with her if she commits her government to back a people's vote. Time is running out. Will she do that in these desperate days?
First Minister.
Well, firstly, Presiding Officer, can I just make clear to the Chamber that I've been worried about Willie Rennie for an awful long time. So I'm glad that at long last he's reciprocating that mutual concern. There's obviously the start of a long and happy friendship there. On the issue of the people's vote, I've made clear in this chamber, I've made clear to others, the SNP are not going to stand in the way of that. So perhaps Willie Rennie should learn to start taking yes for an answer. But as I said the last time he raised this question, there's also an issue that it would be interesting to hear Willie Rennie address. What happens if, yet again, just as in 2016, Scotland votes to remain and the rest of the UK votes to leave? Is it Willie Rennie's proposition that Scotland should simply be ignored all over again? Is it really Willie Rennie's position that the only people's vote on the EU that counts for nothing is the Scottish people's vote? So perhaps if Willie Rennie can address that question, we might make some progress.
Willie Rennie.
But even our own party doesn't agree with her on that anymore either. This is getting serious. Last week, the car manufacturers spoke out. Yesterday, a life-saving drugs trial was cancelled because of Brexit. Today is the Royal Bank of Scotland. They are all warning about Brexit. More people are coming on board with a people's vote too. The First Minister is not leading the country, she's falling behind the country. Look at the list. Former Conservative Cabinet Ministers, senior Labour politicians, and listen to this, and now the whole SNP council group in Aberdeenshire has backed a people's vote. Supporting a people's vote, one SNP councillor said, the only way out of this is to take it back to the people. He's right, isn't he?
First Minister.
Said, we don't stand in the way of a people's vote. If there's a people's vote, I'll be perfectly happy with that. But it doesn't guarantee salvation for Scotland, as we saw in 2016. So Willie Rennie is right about one thing. It is really serious. The Tories are leading Scotland to disaster. In the last few days, we've heard warnings of recession, medicine shortage, pressure in food supplies. We've seen the cancellation of a clinical trial at the Golden Jubilee Hospital. But that, for me, makes this point clearer than ever. Scotland needs the option of independence, because only independence guarantees that these things can't be imposed on us against our will. So the sooner Willie Rennie wants to back that, the better.
A few further supplementaries. The first from Gil Paterson.
Many thanks, Presiding Officer. The First Minister will be aware that the Golden Jubilee Hospital in my constituency conducts numerous world-leading trials on heart disease and heart failure. It was reported yesterday clinical trials of a new drug have been stopped at the hospital because of concerns over Brexit. The work undertaken at Golden Jubilee is of national, if not global, significance. Therefore, will the Scottish Government raise this issue as a matter of urgency with the UK Government, demanding action to allow this groundbreaking research to go ahead, and, as importantly, ensure that this situation does not reflect on the world-leading research carried out at the Golden Jubilee Hospital?
First Minister.
You know, isn't it very telling that as Gil Paterson was asking that really important question, almost every member of the Scottish Conservative benches were looking at their phones or engaging in conversations because they do not want to hear, they do not want to engage in the real damage that their Brexit policy is doing to this country. Gil Paterson is absolutely right to raise this issue. It is incredibly serious. The Golden Jubilee Hospital is particularly active in the field of cardiovascular research. We've invested a further £431,000 this year to continue to support its research activity. This is the first clinical study we are aware of to be suspended in Scotland as a result of Brexit. That is deeply concerning and a real sign of what could happen down the line. I understand these trials are continuing elsewhere in Europe, which just underlines the seriousness of this to Scotland. We are working hard and we will continue to work hard to protect Scotland's interests in spite of a lack of clarity and meaningful engagement from the UK. We will continue to push the UK government for answers to legitimate questions and concerns about the very real risk Brexit poses to research, clinical trials and access to medicines and staff.
Neil Bibby.
Presiding Officer, Amazon, a company with profits of $2.5 billion and which has received more than $3.5 million of Scottish public money, has finally agreed to pay its employees the living wage, affecting 300 workers in the west of Scotland. The First Minister has welcomed this, as we all would, but is she concerned that reports today that many workers, without any consultation, will be financing their own pay rise with cuts to stock options and benefits, including the seasonal incentive, just as we approach Christmas? Many workers apparently believe that they will be worse off as a consequence. If that is the case, will she agree with the GMB that this could be a case of giving with one hand and taking with another? And before handing out any more money to Amazon, will she take into account this and other bad employment practices, including their continued failure to recognise the trade union?
First Minister.
Well, firstly, I welcome the announcement by Amazon earlier this week about payment of the living wage. The Scottish Government, trade unions and others have put a significant amount of pressure on Amazon, so this announcement is particularly welcome. I should say, you know, Neil Bibby talks about public money given by this government to Amazon. The previous Labour administration gave public money to Amazon as well, but it's this government that has pressured Amazon to pay the living wage, and perhaps a bit of recognition of that from Neil Bibby wouldn't have gone amiss. On the issue that's been reported today about share options, we will seek further detail on that from Amazon. If that is true, it is completely unacceptable, and I would absolutely unequivocally condemn that is the case. And we will seek to meet with Amazon both to find out what the situation is there and continue to put pressure on Amazon and on all other companies to treat all of their workers fairly.
James Dornan.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. Will the First Minister update Parliament on the payment of Scotland's new carer allowance supplement? How many payments have now been made, and how will this financial support help carers and their families?
Minister.
Well, more than 75,000 carers have now received the first instalment of the carer's allowance supplement. The supplement, of course, is an additional payment of £442 made in two instalments throughout the year. That's a big investment. It's an increase of 13% on the current carer's allowance. I've had lots of messages over the course of the last couple of weeks from carers saying how much this means to them. Obviously, in practical terms, that money is important to carers who often be struggling to make ends meet. But I've been struck by how many of them have said to me that it's actually about more than the money. It's the message we send about how much we value the contribution that carers make to our society. So let me today yet again put on record my heartfelt thanks to them for all that they do.
John Scott.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. The First Minister will be aware of the Audit Scotland report into NHS funding, particularly NHS Ayrshire and Arran's ability to work within its budgets. Has the First Minister any advice for NHS Ayrshire and Arran on how it might live within its means in future? And does she share my concerns on this matter at the growing indebtedness of NHS Ayrshire and Arran to the Scottish Government?
First Minister.
Well, John Scott obviously is referring to the Audit Scotland Section 22 reports issued this week, referring to NHS Ayrshire and Arran and also NHS Highland. We are working closely with these boards to ensure that we firstly have a full picture of their position in relation to financial management, operational performance and quality of care. And following that work, we will consider the need for any further action to be taken or support to be provided. Of course, I'm aware that the Health Secretary will make a statement to the Chamber this afternoon setting out her views on the financial position, not just now of the NHS, but how we ensure the sustainable financial position of the NHS going forward.
Question number four, Ruth Maguire.
To ask the First Minister what impact the disclosure scheme for domestic abuse in Scotland has had since its introduction in 2015.
First Minister.
The disclosure scheme for domestic abuse in Scotland, introduced after Claire Wood's tragic death, has enabled over 3,500 people to request information for themselves or for someone they feel may be at risk of domestic abuse. The Police Scotland scheme, which I was proud to help announce when it was introduced nationally in 2015, has informed almost 1,600 people about their partner's abusive past, and put simply, this may well have saved lives. It's one of a number of measures which make a difference for victims. The Domestic Abuse Act, passed earlier this year, creates a specific domestic abuse offence that covers not just physical abuse, but also coercive and controlling behaviour, and that sends an unequivocal message that any type of domestic abuse is completely unacceptable.
Ruth Maguire.
Thank the First Minister for that answer. Based on the figures out this week, it's hard to argue that this scheme rolled out after a successful trial in Ayrshire has been anything other than a success. Scottish Women's Aid acknowledge it as a great tool for breaking the silence around coercive control and the violence of domestic abuse, helping women who may have been unaware of their partner's past. How will the Scottish Government continue to promote this scheme and other supports to those who face the threat or live with the reality of a violent or abusive partner?
First Minister.
Well, the scheme has indeed been a success, and I think it's a credit to the dedicated Police Scotland officers and victim support organisations who work tirelessly to support people through the disclosure process and to prevent people becoming victims. Applications from individuals using their right to ask have increased by almost 40% in the last 12 months, which demonstrates that the scheme is being used. The Scottish Government is investing record levels of funding to support victims of gender-based violence through a range of frontline services. That includes funding to Scottish Women's Aid to train a pool of expert coercive control trainers throughout Scotland and development of a range of resources to support groups and external organisations, including local violence against women partnerships. And we will continue this support to make sure that domestic violence is reduced and that victims have as much protection as possible.
Christine Graham.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. On promoting the scheme in this week when we celebrate older people in Age Scotland 75 years, can the First Minister advise if the Government has linked up with Action on Elder Abuse to make older people aware of this disclosure scheme, as domestic abuse knows no age boundaries?
First Minister.
Well, Christine Graham is absolutely right. Domestic abuse is an abhorrent crime, and she's absolutely right to point out that it occurs across society, regardless of age, gender, race, sexuality and wealth. To deliver the scheme, Police Scotland already works closely with a number of independent domestic abuse advocacy and support services. The disclosure scheme, and I want to stress this point, is open to anyone, including concerned relatives, neighbours or friends, who can make an inquiry if they're worried about someone being at risk of domestic abuse. In addition, the police have appointed Safe Lives to train 14,000 officers in identifying controlling behaviours to support the introduction of the new Act, and that will reinforce the fact that domestic abuse can occur in all parts of our society and will include examples of abuse involving older persons. In light of Christine Graham's question, I'm happy to ask officials to look at whether there is more, in conjunction with the police, that can be done to draw attention of this scheme and the wider legislation around domestic abuse to older people in our society.
Question number five, Alexander Stewart.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. To ask the First Minister what action the Scottish Government is taking in response to reports that there has been the biggest rise in HIV infection in Scotland for three decades.
First Minister.
As we have set out in our sexual health and bloodborne virus framework, prevention of HIV transmission remains a priority in Scotland. I'm very proud that Scotland was the first part of the UK to make HIV PrEP available on the NHS last year. We're working closely with NHS boards to reduce bloodborne viruses, and we're providing third sector funding of over £2 million over the next 3 years to organisations dealing with sexual health and bloodborne viruses. Of course, a significant risk factor for people who inject drugs being exposed to HIV is the sharing of injecting equipment. That's why we strongly support Glasgow's proposals for safer injecting facilities. And the Minister for Public Health is meeting with his counterpart in Westminster later this month to discuss the case for urgent action to consider that proposal, or to devolve the necessary powers to allow this government and parliament to consider it.
Alexander Stewart.
I thank the First Minister for that answer. In 2016, funding for alcohol and drug partnerships was cut by £15 million, and the Scottish Government asked health boards to make up the difference. They did not make up that shortfall, and in total, alcohol and drug spending has been reduced since last year. Therefore, can I ask, in this year's budget, will the First Minister and her government commit to being completely transparent and provide the Parliament with a single figure for spending across these treatments?
First Minister.
Well, of course, in last year's programme for government, I indicated increased resources for drug and alcohol treatment services. Our budget this coming year will continue to prioritise action in those areas. I think perhaps a subsidiary question is whether, when it does so, the Scottish Conservatives will actually vote for the budget or vote against it, because they prefer tax cuts for the richest in our society, which would remove the funding we need for these very issues. So we will continue to provide the funding, we will continue to work with the relevant organisations, and we will continue to argue for the innovation in public policy that can help us tackle these issues. That's why the safer injecting facility proposal is so important. And I would say, in all sincerity to the member, perhaps he can help us in trying to persuade his colleagues at Westminster to stop being a block on that proposal.
Alex Cole-Hamilton.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. A Freedom of Information request by the Liberal Democrats reveals that in NHS Lothian, there are currently 125 people waiting up to 84 days for repeat prescriptions for prophylactic HIV medication PrEP. Given HIV is growing and 13% of Scots who have it don't know they have it, will the First Minister and her Cabinet Secretary work with NHS Lothian to end this delay, which is the largest in this country?
First Minister.
Well, the availability of PrEP is important. As I said in my initial answer to this question, Scotland was actually the first part of the UK to make it available on the NHS, and that was the right thing to do. I will certainly discuss with the Public Health Minister and the Health Secretary how we can work with NHS Lothian to make sure that it is available to people who need it as quickly as possible. And I'm sure Alec Cole-Hamilton, we disagree on many things. I think on these issues there's a lot of agreement. He's certainly on occasion been helpful to the government in pursuing some of the policy here. So I will ask the Health Secretary or the Public Health Minister to correspond with him, particularly on this point that he's raised.
Question number six, Rhoda Grant.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. To ask the First Minister what the Scottish Government is doing to ensure that all historic complaints of harassment within its workplace are properly investigated and dealt with.
First Minister.
Well, it's of course a year ago that allegations emerged about Harvey Weinstein, and through the Me Too movement, the world woke up to the experiences that many women face. In light of these concerns, I asked the Permanent Secretary to review the Scottish Government's policies to ensure that staff could have confidence that all complaints would be fully investigated and properly addressed. As part of this, the Fairness at Work policy was reviewed for all staff, and also a new procedure was put in place that allows any historic cases to be considered and ensures that staff are clear about how they can make a complaint. It's absolutely vital that we give people the confidence to come forward in the knowledge that they will be listened to and that their complaint will be fully investigated, irrespective of who the complaint relates to or when they occurred. I'm sure that the whole chamber will agree with me that the complainants should always be at the centre of our thoughts and that we conduct ourselves always in a way that ensures that complainants are properly protected and respected and that complaints are properly investigated.
Rhoda Grant.
The First Minister talked about the Me Too campaign, and it has raised hopes that we develop a very different culture from the one that swept these issues under the carpet. However, it would appear from press reports that some historic complaints were not recorded and not dealt with appropriately or taken seriously. And if this is indeed the case, perpetrators may have gone without challenge, as there was no way of seeing if this behaviour was a course of conduct. Is the First Minister aware of any such cases? And what is she doing about them? What action will she take to ensure proactively that all historical complaints made to the Scottish Government and to any of its agencies have been properly investigated, recorded and dealt with?
First Minister.
No, I'm not aware of any complaint having been swept under the carpet. And let me be very clear, as First Minister, I would not tolerate that being the case. Indeed, it's because I believe and believe so strongly that complaints shouldn't be swept under the carpet that I signed off the new procedure in December that I referred to in my opening answer. I'm very clear and have been consistently clear, as has the Permanent Secretary of the Scottish Government, that when complaints are raised, they should be properly investigated, no matter the seniority or the political affiliation of the person being complained about. And what is important in all cases is that there is due process applied. And the final point I would make here is, I think, and this is directed at all of us across this chamber, I think all of us should refrain from seeking to play party politics on issues that demand proper due process, because to do that risks doing a disservice to those who raise complaints.
Shona Robertson.
Would the First Minister agree with me that the behaviour that we've seen last week from President Trump and several US senators who have effectively put a woman who says she's been a victim of abuse on trial is utterly disgraceful, and that furthermore we should stand together and not allow those who complain to be re-victimised as part of any political or media scrutiny of any harassment investigation?
First Minister.
I absolutely agree. I think many of us, perhaps women in particular, have been horrified at what we have watched unfolding in the United States over the last couple of weeks. I think in this area, leadership is very important, and these issues are not always comfortable. I perhaps know that more than most at this point, but it is at times when things are not comfortable that leaders are tested about whether their rhetoric is just that or whether they're prepared to put that into action. I think it is really important that when people come forward with complaints, they're not put on trial, but that there is due process for all concerned, for those bringing forward complaints and indeed for those being complained about. We mustn't allow complaints to be swept under the carpet. We certainly mustn't allow that to happen because of the identity of the person being complained about. It is vitally important that women, because it mainly, or not exclusively, but mainly in this regard, is women are listened to and their complaints are treated with respect and with due process. And as far as I possibly can as First Minister, I will do everything in my power to make sure that happens.
Thank you very much. And that concludes First Minister's questions. We'll move on shortly to members' business in the name of Elaine Smith on challenging poverty. But before we do so, we'll just take a short suspension to allow the gallery, the public gallery in particular, to clear and for new members of the public to come in to listen to this debate. A short suspension.